Today's guest is a woman of many pursuits, and she is described as someone who knows who she is and why she is here. We'll find out more in just a moment. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. And I'm very pleased to introduce you to Lillianne Green, a woman of many talents. So, Lillianne Green, welcome to Mind Talk.
Well, thank you for having me, Dr. Brewer. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, have I done your first name justice?
Yes, but it's Lillian. I know sometimes it's difficult for people, but it's Lillian.
Okay. So I will try to remember that for the rest of our conversation today. You heard me just describe you as someone who knows who she is and knows why she's here. And so many of us, certainly nowadays, don't know either of those things. So tell us, who are you? Who's Lillian, and why is she here?
Well, I am a poet. I think it has taken me time to find out who I am. But I went through a period of time in my life where I was asking, what am I here for? What am I to do? And by way of some background, my formal training is as an attorney. But that did not feel for me as if though it's what I'm really here to do. And I have literally gone from trying first-degree murder cases to recognizing that there's something else that I should be doing. And I went through this period where I began to wean myself from the law in the sense of being in that adversarial posture, which the law, which the legal profession lends itself to. And I think I opened my spirit up to receive information because I had not been writing poems in my life until they started to come in 2005. And then hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them started to come. And the trigger for the poetry was Hurricane Katrina, my reaction, if you will, to the response or the lack thereof of the U.S. government to the people. And I, at that point in time, was asked to write a commentary for another radio station dealing with Hurricane Katrina. And I was also asked to include in that commentary something about the remarks made by the then I believe he was the Secretary of Education, who made this remark about aborting black babies might reduce crime. And I was so struck by the ease with which such a horrible statement could be made, but also that I was going to write about that, but in a different way. And the word that kept coming to me as a result of him making this statement was how comfortable he was in doing so. Mm. And so the first ever poem that I wrote intentionally was called Comfortable. And I, from then on, had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them come to me. And they have really helped to clarify my life, why I'm here. There's a peace that I get when I'm doing the poetry. There is a connection to spirit that is unlike anything that I experience in the natural world. And it really is a very freeing space to be in, but it's also, for me, very healing. And I like to think that what I write about has the capacity to help others heal.
When you say that you were prosecuting first-degree murder cases, and now you're a poet, I mean, those don't even sound like they're on the same planet, let alone within the same human body.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting you would say that because I've had a number of people who only know me as a poet did not even know I'm an attorney, have no idea I used to try cases or that the cases that I did try were first-degree murder cases. But my poetry, I must say, is informed by the fact that I do have this training and that I have experienced certain things having been involved in that type of work, if you will, but also having had my own life experiences and going through a period of time when, as I examine myself and why I am here, that I too have, believe in the importance and the power of counseling and seeking understanding about who you are and why you behave as you do. And so I've had that as well. And I think that my ability to look in the mirror, to examine self, has also led to the opening up of my spirit to receive information that has come to me in the form of poetry.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about looking in the mirror and seeing who you are, being curious about your own self, because that is such a powerful, I know you know this, and courageous thing to do, quite frankly. And so many people don't give themselves that opportunity to look and to really see and to really learn. Tell us about where you began. Where did you grow up? Who were some of your early influencers?
I was born in a little town called Coatesville, Pennsylvania. It's about an hour west of Philadelphia, literally midway between Philadelphia and Harrisburg.
Okay.
It's a small place. I think as I grew up, the town was probably 60-40 white to black in terms of the demographic. There's one high school. When I graduated from high school, I was the class speaker at high school. I wanted to go to college to be a psychologist. That did not happen because when I got to my freshman year, all of the psychology classes were gone when I got up to the line to register. And what remained were classes in history. And so I took the history classes, and I liked it. And so I stayed with history. And so my undergraduate degree is in history and politics. And I see now how my poetry really is informed by an understanding of history, a desire for the healing that comes with the mental health component, if you will, so that I am, in fact, doing the two things that apparently spirit intended for me to do. I graduated from Howard University School of Law. I was the editor-in-chief of the Law Review, and I had a career trajectory in terms of the law where I'm sure my colleagues and classmates might have thought I'd be a judge by now, but my first job out of law school was to clerk for a federal judge, and then I worked at a Wall Street law firm in New York, and then I came to Washington, D.C., where I was an assistant U.S. attorney, and that's where I was trying criminal cases and ultimately first-degree murder cases. I had a private practice for a while, and then there came this time when I began to really look at what I was doing, was it giving me any sort of joy, if you will, peace, and asking the Creator, why am I here? And that's when I think I started that period of time that I called the weaning from doing the like the hardcore trial work and looking towards who I am in an inward way to try to find out why I'm here. And the poems surprised me as much as they did anybody else because I had written what I called a children's book. It's called Because I Love You. And that really actually is the very first poem that I wrote, but I wrote that in 2001, could not read it publicly, wasn't even thinking about it as a poem, merely a book to read to children that happens to rhyme. And I had not been able to read it without crying until 2003. And I realized at one point that although I thought I was writing it for other children, that I was really writing it for little Sir Lillian. And at one point, it's going to be a children's book. It hasn't happened yet. But for a period of time, that was the only poetry I had. And people were constantly asking me when I would read it, but where are your other poems? And I would say, well, no, I'm not a poet. I just have this one. And I read it at weddings and babies' blessings and church anniversaries. And little did I know that the people were telling me that you are indeed a poet, but I didn't know it. Let's put it that way.
And again, you know, there are many of us who have sort of an inward capacity to gift others and self in a way that we may not know. And it does sometimes take the noticing of the other for us to look and see within.
Most definitely, most definitely. And that certainly was the case for me because when the poem started, I was really very surprised. And I remember calling a friend and saying, I wrote a poem. And then I wrote another poem and another. And after a while, they just continued to come. And they haven't stopped. It's just that period when they first started was really a fertile period for me. And I appreciated the connection that I was having. And I found that poetry, unlike prose, is a very accessible medium. People will listen to a poem in ways they might not listen to or certainly read other things. And for me, having never studied poetry, I was really concerned that I didn't know the rules of procedure about poetry because when you're in law school, you learn procedure. You learn civil procedure,
right.
You learn criminal procedure, you learn appellate procedure. There's an order to how you do things. And I didn't know what the rules were for poetry. And I found myself, well, all right, this is how they come to you. They come to you in a certain way. So it's important for you to write them the way they come. And there was always a rhythm to them. And I typically write in these couplets, which I learned later, are two stanzas. But I would always seek to write in a way that the rhythm of the poem would be there, whether I was there reading it to you or you were reading it yourself, that you would feel the rhythm and the vibration. Because I think as an African American woman and a woman of African descent, that rhythm is critical to how we process information, and particularly information that may be painful to hear.
Tell us a little bit more about that first poem that you wrote, Comfortable.
Well, Comfortable, the word comfortable just kept staying with me because I couldn't imagine that on the heels of Hurricane Katrina and the disaster that was, that we would hear from someone in the administration that this could reduce crime, aborting black babies. And particularly when you have a certain segment of the population that is so, as they say, pro-life. And the ease with which this was said was really very disheartening. And it resulted in a number of people protesting at the radio station of that individual. But I just kept feeling that I must say something about it. And so the word comfortable came to me. And I wrote a poem about that. And that was really the catalyst for all of the others that have come. And
what did you say in that poem?
Pardon me?
What did you say in that poem?
Oh, okay. So the poem starts out, how comfortable can a white man be with his status in a white society to suggest that people who look like me should abort our babies? How comfortable can a white man be to feel threatened by a yet conceived black baby? And it goes on to discuss the level of comfort that you must have, but it concludes with how uncomfortable he really must be. And from then on, I had poems come to me from titles, from words that people would say to me. I've had people suggest a poem to me that apparently was already in me, but I did not know. And I've been really fortunate to, I think, have this connection with this type of creativity, because I do feel that whatever your spiritual practice or discipline, that the first thing that your God, your creator does is to create. And that when we are creating, we are closest to the creator. And that for me, it has been poetry.
It's interesting that you continue to refer to your poetry as this entity almost that comes to you and through you. Can you say more about that?
Well, I feel that it is in many ways an entity, in that it is from a spiritual place that I do not control, and that it has been given to me in such a fashion that I recognize that it could not be me, because I was not studying poetry, did not study poetry, read very little poetry growing up, and I'm a voracious reader. I really enjoy reading. I've been in book groups, started a book group, but poetry was not one of the things that we were reading. And I find that there is something in the spiritual dimension of who I am that opened up to receive the information. And this is the only way that I can explain what happened to me. And the responses of people around me who thought I had been doing this all of my life, which I was not. Mm. And a recognition of the fact that there is something really wonderful about having this kind of connection and this type of experience, particularly when the words come, are able to do some healing work for people who really need that.
You earlier were talking about where you were born and you grew up, and I asked you who were some of the early influencers in your life, and I believe that you have some poetry that speaks to those early influencers, mother and father. Can you share the mother poem with us?
Both my parents are still alive, and I'm very fortunate in that, because my most of my friends only have one parent. But my mother is a singer, She has a wonderful, wonderful voice. And growing up, she would sing in my little town. She would sing at lots of different events. She'd be the soloist. And one of the things that I think formed me in terms of what I was capable of doing is that we attended a Presbyterian church because they sang in the way that suited my mother's voice. However, we were the only black family in this church, and that was a very interesting dynamic, so much so that I did not know that there were black people who were Presbyterians until I went to law school.
Interesting.
Because when I was in law school, I rented a room from a woman who was a black woman who was a Presbyterian, and I was stunned. And I would go to her church occasionally to see what it was like. But my mother's voice is something that resonates for me. And the poem that I wrote for her is called Mom's Voice. And it starts out, her voice, her voice, her voice. My mom's voice was not her choice. It's a gift from God above, a gift from God with love. It's the voice I've heard all of my life through all of her struggle, toil, and strife. A singing voice of pure splendor calling for complete surrender. Her voice constant and serene belied the pain that was unseen. So deserving of a love supreme, the love that seemed the elusive dream. Sought outside from those who could be seen instead of on the inside where love is pure and pristine. But through it all, her voice remains supreme. And to hear her sing, you might think it's a dream. Because who could have a voice so serene? The voice of an angel is how it's been described. Her voice can bring tears to your eyes. Her voice, her voice, her voice was God's highest choice. Her voice brought me to life in the second year as my dad's wife. And through her voice, my mom called my name, firstborn child, my claim to fame. And through her womb is how I came to have the voice that I now claim. So that's part of it. And I feel like I have a voice as a poet, not as a singer, but I think of my poetry as my singing voice. And so that's my tribute to my mom, mom's voice.
That is actually, it's beautiful. And there's a way that you write that you create pictures in the minds of the readers, I would suggest. Is that your intention when you create, to create a picture, a visual picture and an emotional picture?
I've been told that I do that. I don't know that it was my intention initially, because I don't know that I even had an intention. I think the guidance of spirit was how the poems came to me. But I do feel that when I'm writing, I am telling a story, and that in the case of my mom's voice, if you ever hear her sing, you would know that what I'm saying is true, because her voice will ring true. And I feel that that is the most empowering compliment I can give to her, because of how she continues to sing. And she and I did an event in 2017 where she did Negro spirituals and I did poetry. And so I realized that this tribute to her in the way of a poem for me is my way of acknowledging the gift that she shared with us and with others who were not in our family, who've gotten to and continue to hear her sing.
So Lillianne Green, who today comes to us as a poet, I've heard her describe herself as a reformed attorney. Hope that's not telling tales out of school.
No, I like to say I'm a recovering lawyer.
So Lillianne, read The Hat Man for us, if you would.
Certainly. Hat Man is my tribute to my dad. My dad is from the era of the men who wore hats. And so this is a poem that was inspired at the funeral of my father's brother. When he passed, his children put his hat in his coffin. Mm. And at the time they closed the casket, I was literally holding my dad's hat in my lap. And the poem came to me following that funeral. It's called Hat Man. My dad is a hat man from a different era. Now that I'm older, it could not be clearer. He's worn a hat all of my life through all of his struggle, toil, and strife. My dad is a hat man from down south. Each of his hats is a wide-open mouth, ready to savor his keen intellect, ready to garner well-deserved respect. Because once my dad opens his mouth, you know he knows what he's talking about. His intellect is kept warm inside the brim, unlike the hatless whose intellect is cold and thin. But a hat man does remove his hat every now and then, depending on the situation and the place he's in. As a courtesy to a woman, out of respect in the house of God, He'll remove his hat slowly and politely nod. For my dad, his hat is not a fad, here today and gone tomorrow. His hats are not something you can ask to borrow. His hats represent his time and place, an extension of men born of his class and race. A hat distinguished men born of his generation. They wore hats with clear sophistication. My dad and his hat bring comfort to me. Seeing him in it is how I expect him to be. My dad is a hat man through and through, and if I didn't see him in it, I don't know what I'd do. Without his hat, my dad is not the same. Like a horse without a mane, a fire without a flame. My dad and his hat are truly tethered, and you'll see him in it no matter the weather. So that's just part of it, but it really does go on to speak to when he wears a hat, the size of his hat. And nothing I have ever done in my life has brought tears to my dad's eyes like this poem. When he heard me read it, he cried, and it moved me so much that he was so moved by something I have done, and nothing certainly that I had ever done as an attorney. So I realized that these poems tap a space in people that I could never even imagine, and yet it is the most gratifying of experiences when people come up to you and tell you your words have made a difference.
The idea that African Americans write poetry, write books. There was, I suggest, a time when that seemed a bit of an anomaly for some. And they didn't believe that it happened, that it was real, that black people bought books, read books, bought poetry, read poetry. What do you say to that? Is that still a belief in some circles, or would you say that time has passed? People now know better.
Well, I think some people know better. But I do believe we have to recognize that in the history of this country, there were literally anti-literacy laws that precluded teaching us to read and to write as people of African descent. And indeed, there were laws and penalties for it. And I've actually done some work on this so that people understand that if you were a enslaved person who happened to learn how to read and you were caught teaching someone to read, that the penalty would be at a minimum 20 lashes up to possibly 39 on your bare back. But if you were a white person who got caught teaching someone to read, that the penalty would be a fine. But if you were a free person of color, it could be a fine and lashes. So the parallels between what's happening in terms of punishment for being caught teaching someone to read, knowing how to read, and the penalties and the disparities between something like crack versus powder cocaine, that there is a history in this country of punishing us more severely, more harshly. But at the same time, the idea that we don't read, we have always wanted to read. We have always known that education was a key, that was a part of the freedoms that we were fighting for in the Civil War that happened in this country. And indeed, there are photographs of black people who were formerly enslaved having books and writings about how far they walked to get an education and how everybody was trying to get this education because we knew the importance of it. So I think the fiction continues to exist among those who want to believe that we don't read, that we don't write, and we don't want to. I do recognize that this notion of social media has taken its space, its place, if you will, and that people do watch a lot of videos, but there are those of us who continue to write and many of us who continue to read, because without the readers, you wouldn't need the writers. And so I do think that there is a fiction to that, but that we and people like you who give me a voice to be on your program can help dispel that notion.
There are some young people who believe that learning, going to school, getting a quote-unquote education, because there are many kinds of educations that people can get in school, that none of that is really as important as making money. So there are those who believe that if you can make a dime, you don't need to know how to spell the word dime. If you can make $1 million, who cares that you know where it came from and the best way to invest it? What do you say to those folks?
I say it's unfortunate because you have to recognize that those people who are here of African descent, by and large, are descended of people who came here with no money. And the fact that you can do whatever it is you do now is because the people who had the ingenuity, the creativity to lay a foundation that you can operate from now requires a recognition on your part that there is a value to education and a value to living beyond merely the accumulation of money. And if we look at the capitalist construct that exists in this country, the whole idea of enslaving a people simply for profit and gain really tells you the depths to which we could go as a people if we were only guided by the acquisition of a dollar. So I would definitely speak to people in the ways that let you know that there is more to life and to being than merely the accumulation of a dollar. There's the need for a moral center, an understanding of who you are and where you come from, and what people have done to make it possible for you to do those things that you are able to do today.
As you speak, the historian part of you comes forth. And I was really interested as I was reading your latest book, A Bridge, the Poetic Primer on African and African-American Experiences. There are several poems that struck me particularly, as you and I have talked, but share with us, if you would, the Roads to Scholarship poem, what that's about and what that means, and it's on page 52 if you didn't already know that.
Okay. Well, the Roads to Scholarship is inspired by Cecil Rhodes and the atrocities that he committed in what was Rhodesia, the country that he named for himself. And he really is the architect of apartheid that existed in southern Africa. And yet once they removed him and renamed the country, he was able to create a scholarship in his name. So the history that deals with him we know in the form of the Rhodes Scholarship and the Rhodes Scholar. And the poem, Rhodes to Scholarship, really speaks to what it is that he did, and so that people understand who get these Rhodes Scholarships on whose backs they stand. And it starts out, Cecil Rhodes, one of the architects of apartheid, brutalized Africans with immense pride. During his reign of terror across southern African land, he renamed the land Rhodesia as he implemented his plan. For the British, for the crown, for his queen, Africans he regularly demeaned. Cecil Rhodes destroyed Africans one by one. There is an enduring shame in what he has done. In an effort to recast his image and remove his shame, a scholarship now bears his name. Some who want or need the scholarship may pretend they don't know what Rhodes did to begin. Others are ignorant and simply don't know the facts. Rhodes committed horrors against people whose skin was black. With African bodies, the roads to scholarship have been paved, murdered men, women, and children, some in mass graves. For eager students who travel the roads to scholarship, truth should be the main tool with which they are equipped. The truth is what students should learn and never forget as they study, question, and reflect. Reflect on the brutality of this British man, the ideal model for America's Ku Klux Klan. Thus, for scholars who carry the legacy of Cecil Rhodes, pour libation for the countless Africans whom he disposed. Pour libation for Africans, their land, and for their birth. Pour libation for their dignity and for their worth. Finally, Rhodes scholars should raise their hands, raise them to honor the Africans on whose graves they stand. And so that's a piece of education for those who may not know where the Rhodes Scholarship has its roots.
And so for those who are recipients of the Rhodes Scholarship, which is considered a huge honor, for those who are of African descent, it's kind of a difficult thing to wrap your brain around, I would think. Here you're getting this honor, but it's honors on the backs of your ancestors.
It is, and so many of the honors that we receive are on the backs of our ancestors. There's a book out called Ebony and Ivy about all of the people who were involved in enslaving African people who started these Ivy League institutions, and it's very powerful. from Harvard to Princeton, Yale, all of what they were doing, Georgetown here in Washington, D.C., what they were doing to maintain and continue to promote the enslavement of African people. And yet now they're held as pillars of our community in terms of the education, and which is fine that they are providing education, but let us not forget where and on whose backs you built these institutions, because in some cases they were recruiting the Southern planters to have their children come to their schools and were encouraged to bring their maids and their servants with them. So this is part and parcel of what has happened, I think, certainly in this country and indeed maybe around the world as it relates to the utilization of the black body for things that are repugnant on the human scale, and at the same time being able to create institutions that are worth multi-millions of dollars in endowments, and now we can benefit from what our ancestors did. So to me, in many ways, these institutions should provide just free education to anyone of African descent. That might seem a little bit extreme, but certainly these institutions now are the way they are in terms of their endowments because they have a foundation that was built with free labor in many cases.
How do you want listeners to think about? I mean, you're giving us historical information. It's certainly in some cases, if not many cases, you're giving us information that we were not aware of. What do we do with this? And not to mention, I thought poetry was supposed to be fun and all about love and hugs and kisses, and you're not doing that.
Well, I have some hugs and kisses poems.
Okay.
I do have some hugs and kisses poems. But I think that I have an obligation to write what is brought to me and to write it in such a way that it can be received. So for people who did not know about Cecil Rhodes, people who did not know about the origin of the Rhodes Scholarship, well, now that you do know, you'll be more informed to talk about it because knowledge really is power. And I think for so long things have been hidden and more is coming to light. But if you recognize where the money and the largesse comes from that Cecil Rhodes has a scholarship, why does he have a scholarship? If you know why he has a scholarship, you can be more informed about how you proceed and how you operate in this world because the benefit from that educationally will, in the long run, do something good for you and maybe others in terms of what you do out here in the world. But you need to understand the person and the foundation because there's a principle in the Akan tradition known as the Sankofa. And it's about looking at the past to understand what has happened and where you are going to go in the future. And if you are operating in a vacuum, that does you no good, it does society no good. And so I really think that the more we know, the better we are, then the more informed we are, the better we will be as a society and as individuals. And I think the same is true for your family structure, that there are things that happen in families, like the secrets and the lies that we keep in families. And the truth is always present. The truth is always present, and eventually it will reveal itself. So that the healing that will need to take place for a country or the healing that needs to take place for a people is rooted in an understanding of the past and dealing with it in a healthy and wholesome way and not being afraid to face the truth because it's always there.
So Lillian, you have written a poem called Did You Know? I want you to share Did You Know with us. It's on page 17, in case you don't know.
Okay, Did You Know? This is another example of how my poetry is informed by my legal training. Because we often hear people say, oh, slavery is over. Why are we still talking about slavery? Well, it's not over. So this poem is called Did You Know? Did you know slavery has not been abolished? In the United States, slavery has not been demolished. There is an exception in the 13th Amendment. It lets you know ending slavery was not fully intended. The lawmakers of 1865 meant to keep institutionalized slavery alive. They wrote their intentions plainly in black and white. Slavery can continue as part of prison life. Read the 13th Amendment sometime. Then you'll know what was on the lawmakers' minds. I tell you this fact in case you didn't know. Now you must say, I told you so. And the 13th Amendment is really very clear. Slavery can continue in prisons. And the unfortunate aspect of what's going on in this country today is there's a book out called The New Jim Crow about this prison industrial complex and what is happening to the criminalization of the black males and now increasingly black women, so that the prisons are now where you have slavery, and it never ended. They could always continue to enslave you in prisons. And that still is the case. As we talk right now, that is still the case.
So again, what you are doing in your work is teaching us, informing us, and you're giving it to us in ways that we can take it in. Because sometimes, you know, with this kind of information that you and I are talking about today, it can be written in a way that is just sort of emotionally dense, and it's hard to take in. And it's hard to hold on to. But in the way that you present it in your poetry, you kind of can't not take it in.
Right. I've been told that, too. I have had many people say, you make it so easy to understand. And I think that's the beauty of poetry and the gift that has been given to me to say these things in a way that people can receive them. Because I have poems about domestic violence. I have poems about love. And I have a poem in particular about about domestic violence, but it's in the voice of the abuser. And the poem is called Hands-On Experience. And it starts out, if I put my hands on you in a threatening way, your life is in danger, get out, don't stay. The reason I batter doesn't really matter. Someone who batters is someone who batters. But the entire poem is the batterer saying, this is what I'm doing, that when I get help and clean up my act, then I will make contact. Until then, you begin your life again. And it goes on with this batterer saying, I have a problem. I need help. And people are able to hear that in ways that they might not hear other things. And because it's uniquely in the voice of the batterer explaining, I have a problem. I need some help. And that I batter you is not meant to flatter. So I do appreciate your recognition of the ability to hear my poetry in a way that you might not be able to hear other things. So thank you for that.
Absolutely my pleasure and my honor. I mean, your work is really, I think, quite wonderful. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like you to share with us a Loves and Hugs poem. That's what I'm looking for.
Okay, Loves and Hugs. Okay.
All right. Folks, listening to author, among many things, author Cillian Green, author of A Bridge, the poetic primer on African and African-American experiences, is just one of her publications. We'll be right back. Green, you talked earlier about being an attorney, a criminal attorney, and you've also worked as a mediator. Do you practice either of those pursuits today?
No, I was a former assistant U.S. attorney, so I don't do that any longer. But I do work in the area that deals with mediation. I interview people who are going to participate in mediation now, but I really enjoy and appreciate the importance and the power of mediation, particularly in communities where people do not have a paradigm of a conflict resolution model that involves conversation and talking through. That if your model of how we discuss the problem is to yell, scream, curse, walk out, don't talk, then mediation is truly a gift of that we as a community, particularly an African-American community, who may not have had access to healthy conflict resolution models. And so I really view it as just an important way, whether you are married, single, you could do it in your business practices as well, to figure out ways that are healthy for you to begin to have a conversation by talking about how certain things make you feel, and then validating and valuing how the other person feels. And I think this is part of the challenge that we face as a country, an inability to accept how other people feel about what is happening, as if though there's no value, no validity to the feeling space. And to me, the feeling space is the power place, because we all have an IQ, but I think the more important thing is the emotional quotient, the EQ, because that is really going to govern how you actually behave. Because intellectually, you can know to do a thing, but emotionally is what the thing that you will do. So I do understand that.
Tell us the difference between mediation and arbitration.
Well, mediation, the parties are actually there in the room having a conversation amongst themselves with a third person neutral who is the mediator, who helps them to actually have a conversation where they talk about what their issue is. In the context of family mediation, sometimes the parties have a difficulty being in a room together, so they're able to have a mediation where they're in separate rooms and the mediator goes between them, sort of like shuttle diplomacy, and then there are others where the parties are on video monitors where they actually have a conversation. But the point is that they are communicating with each other to help resolve their differences so that they can get to a space where they're able to communicate in a healthy way going forward, particularly when you have children, because that's going to be for the remainder of your lives.
Sure.
Arbitration is like a mini trial in the sense that the arbitrator listens to the parties. It's set up similar to a trial. You have a plaintiff, you have a defendant, and the arbitrator listens to you, and then the arbitrator makes a decision as to what is going to happen. So the mediation empowers the parties. Arbitration really empowers, keeps the arbitrator in power, and the arbitrator is the ultimate decision maker.
So if someone wanted to get some more information from you about your mediation services, would that be a thing that would be possible?
Sure, they can contact me on my website. My website is my name, CeliliaGreen.com, and Cilillian is spelled C-E, capital L-I-L-L-I-A-N-N-E, and green like the color, G-R-E-E-N, all one word, CeliliaGreen.com, and they can email me, and that would be great.
Okay. Before the break, I asked you to share with us a warm and fuzzy. You got one?
I have one. I have one about male-female relationships, but I thought I would do this one called I Didn't Know.
Okay.
And I didn't know is one of my sisters told me that when I wrote this poem, that this was really about me giving birth to the poetry. But this is my Mother's Day poem that I tend to read because it's about mother's love. Mm. I didn't know. I didn't know I could love like this. I didn't know I could experience such bliss. I didn't know when you were born in you my heart would now be worn. I had no idea my child could take my heart and teach me to love from my deepest part. I didn't know how much I had to learn or that from this love I would never return. I had no concept of love like this or that between us this love would always persist. I didn't know the joy of seeing your tiny lips or the power of feeling your tender kiss. I didn't know that in your eyes I would now see the sunrise. I would see the sunrise and never forget that because of you, God and I met. I didn't know that when I bore a child, I would be intoxicated by your smile, or that I would gladly shed my tears to erase your doubts and remove your fears. Carrying you in my womb has allowed me to fully bloom. I have bloomed and made room. I've made room for love like this, love I could never dismiss. You are my child, the fruit of my loins. In the power of love, we are forever joined. Joined in a love that will never set as long as tears continue to be wet. A love like this I'd never known, but with your birth I've been shown. You've shown me the power of motherhood. Before you it was a power I misunderstood. And I will use this power to move heaven and earth to make sure you know your value and your worth. With you I've experienced love in its purest form, the love for which I was born. Before you, I didn't know there was love like this. Now I know why I exist. So I do not have children of my own, but I feel like in many ways I have given birth to children in the form of my poetry, and mothers tend to really love this poem, and I come from a mother, so I share. I didn't know.
It's an absolutely exquisite poem, and it is about warm and fuzzy, absolutely, and the power of love. A mission accomplished.
Thank you.
As you move through your poetry, do you find that you are informed mostly by the news or by personal moments in your life, or how does that happen?
I think it's a combination of both, because sometimes poems come to me from a word or a phrase or something that I see or hear. And then I've had, for example, I had a friend of mine who's, she's an attorney, and she called me one day some years ago about a Law Review article she was working on dealing with the NCAA and how they treated a young athlete who got hurt. And once he got hurt, he was sent home. He wasn't allowed to keep his scholarship. Pardon me. And so she wanted some sort of poem about the NCAA. And I'm like, I don't have any poems about the NCAA. And then literally that evening, after we got off the phone, a poem started to come to me, and it was really interesting. I'm like, oh, my goodness, you do have a poem about this. And so the poem is published in this Law Review article, and it's called No Need to Read. And it's all about how the athletes are treated at the college level, that there's no need to read. All you need to do is kick, bounce, or throw your ball, stay in your stall. You're a thoroughbred. And it's all about the way in which they were treated. There's a little more that is done in terms of education. Now, at the time, if you got hurt, your scholarship was done. So now I think if you get hurt, you can still continue to matriculate in school. So there was no pretense when she was working on this article that they really cared about you getting an education. They really cared about your ability to bounce a ball, throw a ball, or whatever sport they brought you into the school for. And notwithstanding the amounts of money, the almost obscene amounts of money that these school programs make on the backs of these young players.
That the young players do not get a part of, their payment being their scholarship.
Yes, yes, which is, again, almost laughable, too, when you think about what they pay these coaches, in many cases paid more than the president of the university.
And that's a whole other conversation.
Yes.
Tell us about Marketing Your Madness. That's another poem that you have written that comes from a bridge.
Marketing Your Madness. Well, Marketing Your Madness is based on this notion of the ad campaign, if you will, the psychological propaganda that continues to exist, where people are made to think that there is that you are less than, that there is something about you that is not quite human. And unfortunately, in this country, the initial framers of the Constitution put in a provision that really identified enslaved African people as three-fifths of a human being for purposes of the representation of the white people in Congress. So they got representation for your very existence. But even that representation would only count you as three-fifths of a human. So this notion that you're not quite a person could drive you to madness. And so Marketing Your Madness sort of speaks to that. And I can, I'll share part of it because it's a little bit long. But
okay.
It starts with precision and gladness. I've marketed your madness. I proclaimed your madness repeatedly because your genius has terrified me. I violently forced you into emotional distress. I label myself as the best. With your emotional distress came severe memory loss. Then you accepted that I am the boss. I took full advantage of your memory loss. Generations of your descendants pay the ultimate cost. The cost in low self-worth and lost identity, as I convinced you that you want to be me. I lied to your parents and grandparents, too. Most of them believed what I said was true. I marketed my lies as truth. With so much memory loss, I didn't need proof. Your parents, your grandparents, your family tree were all subjected to marketing by me. I had a comprehensive marketing plan, campaign, designed to leave you mentally drained, easy to control and easy to contain. I marketed your madness with arrogance and impunity. I did so as if I had immunity. I did not consider you a full member of the human race. I persuaded you to reject your body, your face. Your language and customs I tried to erase. Your culture I consistently debased, unless I could find a profit space. I promoted these ideas fervently, repeating them until you believed me. And you did believe me. You bleached your skin, betrayed your friends for me. You reduced your lips and hid your hips, all for me. You straightened your hair, even altered your nose. I thought you would do anything I proposed. You accepted my lies about who you really are. I told you that you would not go very far. The marketing and campaign was nearly complete when I began to sense defeat. My centuries of lies were slowly revealed. You began to deeply feel. Feel the legacy of pain you had to heal in order to remember what's true, what's real. So there's more to that poem, but I think the point is that there's a turning point when you begin to remember who you are. And I think that's part of what's happening now, that there is more information out here which can help us to remember, to begin to do the work of healing so that you can like put yourself back together again and understand who you were before this marketing campaign started happening. And marketing is really a psychological ploy to get you to purchase a product and to believe in something. And so if I marketed your madness or marketed this idea that you are less than human, then I've succeeded in helping to undermine who you are and who you will be as you matriculate through the world.
Do you get concerned, or do you believe that there is a particularly heinous marketing campaign going on in the world today, or no?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think this concerned, yes, but I do think that if you understand history, for instance, that in this country, for instance, at the end of the Civil War, we had that period of 12 years of Reconstruction, which was an amazing time period in terms of what formerly enslaved people were able to accomplish in this country in 12 years. And it so upset the white people, who felt that black people had accomplished far too much, so that we had what was called the Rutherford B. Hayes-Tilden Compromise, where they removed the former protections of troops in the southern states. The planters were given back their property. And at the end of Reconstruction, they removed the Congress people who had been elected to Congress. And at the end of Reconstruction, which was 1877, we then have the development of the Black Codes, the Jim Crow laws, the Ku Klux Klan, and we have lynching. So the level of violence in this period of time, which is called the Nadir, N-A-D-I-R, towards us is just vicious. And there is a statement that was put into the Congressional Record upon the removal of the black Congress people that never again would a black person ever reach that level of power and influence in this country. And so with the election of President Obama, that has really, I think, tapped into a DNA memory of the people who felt that never again would something like that happen. And so now we're faced with what we're dealing with in this country in terms of the current administration. But I do think that there is around the world this notion, the false notion, that some people who have European descent are somehow superior to everyone else, which is not true. You know, there was a period of time when Great Britain said that the sun never set on the British Empire, and they were undermining people in various parts of the world, and this is how we got Gandhi. So I do think that there is more that is happening now to fight that, but there is still that mindset that exists among many, and it's very unfortunate, and we're seeing it in this country writ large in terms of what is currently happening regarding the immigration policies of this administration, this notion of how we're separating these parents from their children at the border. So there are things that are currently happening that we can see every day, and now that we have the media, the social media, to broadcast this around the world, this is a very, very difficult, if not dangerous, time for us as a country and for the people of the world.
How do we survive? Well.
Wow. How do we survive? I think the knowing the history of America, how did we survive it before? Okay. What did we do? And I think there are lessons that can be learned from the past to see how we did survive this before, because it has happened before. And it's almost like when you see an animal backed up against the wall, they become far more violent. But what did we do collectively, particularly for African-American people, what did we do during the period of Jim Crow? What did we do during the period of the lynchings? How did we survive? What did we do to sustain ourselves as a people? How much more cooperative were we with each other? And this is not to say that we are a monolith and everybody spoke with one voice, because this was certainly not the case. You clearly had the Booker T. Washington and Du Bois, you know, approach to what we should be doing. But I do think that there are lessons that can be learned about how this was handled in the past, and the notion that people are continuing to speak out about what is happening to us, because we as African-American people have experienced a tremendous amount of violence, and now the brown people are experiencing that as well. And the difficulties that we faced and had to overcome and are still trying to overcome, because I think so many thought, oh, this was already taken care of. And we see, no, it was never really taken care of. It was just suppressed. And what do we do now to educate the young people? And I think the young people are clearly getting a firsthand lesson in what racism really is. And the killings, the indiscriminate killings of black people, these encounters with law enforcement that could result in your death. And I have a poem I've written about that called Casual Killing. And Casual Killing is based on the Virginia Slave Code called An Act About the Casual Killing of Slaves, which was enacted so that if during the meeting out of punishment you happen to kill your, quote, slave, it would be deemed a casual killing. And so my poem speaks to something that was written in the 1600s, which is really happening now. So the past is always in the present. So what do we do? What do we do in the past that we can now replicate to help us move forward in the future? Because we can't continue to go down like the dead end road. And I think for America, the moral compass that people of African descent have been for this country needs to be revisited. And so much of what we did had a spiritual connection that I think in some ways is, I don't want to say totally lost, but there is certainly a lessening, if you will, of spiritual connections in our communities that perhaps need to be retapped, regardless of what affiliation you're in. Some sense that there is something greater that you can do, and tapping into a spiritual power and dimension, I think, could be of great assistance to us, particularly when you think that the Middle Passage, and from my perspective, the survival of the Middle Passage on those ships coming across the Atlantic Ocean for months at a time, that was not merely a physical survival, that was a spiritual survival of a people who vowed in some way in their spirit that they were going to live. And so you have to tap into that, I think, as we move forward.
So Lillian Green, it sounds like we must have you back, because we are out of time today. But it sounds like we're going to have you back to read some more of your work.
Well, I'd love to come back. Thank you for having me, Dr. Brewer.
Well, it's my pleasure, and we will figure that out very soon. Folks, thank you for joining us today. So Lillian Green, author of A Bridge, the Poetic Primer on African and African-American Experiences. So Lillian, would you give us your website one more time?
Sure. It's LillianGreen.com. That's my full name, and it's spelled CELILLIANNE. GREEN.com, so LillianGreen.com, and you can email me through my website.
Terrific. Thank you again so much, Lillian. And folks, don't worry, we are going to have her back. Thank you all for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a mental health, medical health, or other professional. You can always listen to Mind Talk on demand by going to mynd.talk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from your iTunes or Google Play Store. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening today, so do send an email to me at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.